just misunderstood. We're going to be looking at the parable of the 10 virgins today. It is in Matthew chapter 25, verses 1 through 13. But I'm going to have to give quite a bit of background information before we get into the parable. So, first of all, this is just an overview of what the lesson is all about. The Pharisees focused on the don'ts, unfamiliar wedding customs. Then we'll read the parable, and then we'll talk about what is the oil, and then deal with the question, will the lamp you received still be burning at midnight? Okay, so that's an overview. You can see where we're going and how fast or slow we get there by keeping those points in mind. So let's first look at the Pharisees focused on the don'ts. If you're looking at the commandments in the Old Testament, there's supposedly 613 of them. If you go to Wikipedia and just put in 613 commandments, you can find a list of those commandments. And 248 of those are do's and 365 are don'ts. The rabbis related that 365 to the days of the year, and they said, that's one don't for every day of the year. I'm not sure if that's get you as excited as it got them, but if you take away all of the things that are no longer applicable, that is, you know, if there's a commandment that says, offer an animal sacrifice, or here's where you put the ashes from the altar, if you take away all of those commandments, there are 77 positive commands and 194 negative ones, for a total of 271 for today's person trying to keep the law. Okay, notice the proportion, the 77 to the 194. That just shows that God understands we're more motivated by the stick than the carrot. I mean, that's true. That's the way it goes. So I wouldn't necessarily say the Pharisees were too focused on the don'ts, but they were definitely focused on the don'ts. And Jesus' ministry, to a large degree, is focusing on the do's. Okay, so I'm just going to be giving you some examples of that, not just in this parable, but in other things that Jesus taught. You know, we have the silver rule of Hillel. Hillel was a rabbi, a teacher of the Jews at the time Jesus was a child. That was his heyday. And Hillel said this as a rule of ethics. He said, don't do to others what you don't want them to do to you. So another way of summarizing that would just be live and let live. Okay. In other words, don't go around harming other people. Okay, it reminds me of one time I had a student who was from Queens, and he said when he was a child, he used to go through the neighborhood turning over trash cans and laughing and running to the next trash can and turning it over. And one day, this Italian guy comes running out of his house after he turned over his trash can. He says, I know what bothers you. Why you don't bother me? And that's kind of the summary of what Hillel's silver rule is all about. You know, don't do to others what you don't want them to do to you. The problem with it, I mean, it's a good ethic. There's nothing wrong with it, but it's just inadequate. And the big problem with that ethic is store dummies can do it. You know, we could even buy some and put them in the pews, and they would never lie, they would never cheat, they would never commit adultery, they would never, and that never. And they're here every time the doors are open. Okay, so and you can even do that without a head. At least the guys can. You know, you don't have to, But there's something wrong with that if you're so focused on the don'ts that you're not even worried about the do's. And Jesus' rule is much better, the golden rule. So in everything, do to others as you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law and the prophets. And Jesus also talked about the two greatest commands. Now watch for the don'ts in these two greatest commands, right? First one is, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul. Jesus adds, and with all your mind, and with all your strength. And before we go any farther, I want you to notice how Moses phrased this, or how God phrased this, and Moses wrote it down. Notice that it doesn't say, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and strength. Heart, soul, and strength. But each one has that phrase written out in front of it, that prepositional phrase, with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. Jesus adds, with all your mind. All right, so it's what it's creating for us is a picture of the whole person. That's really everything that you are, is your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Okay? And all of that together is what you're loving God with. Okay? And the second is like it, Leviticus 19, verse 18, love your neighbor as yourself. Now, where's the negative in there? Where's the don'ts? It's not there. Okay? Love the Lord your God with everything you have, and as that defines who you are, that's that person defined that way is worth loving, and therefore love your neighbor as you love yourself, defined as the Lord has defined it. Okay? And that sums up all of the law and the prophets. Okay? So there's really an emphasis on the do's in Jesus' ministry, and he carries that out in many different passages. For example, in the Sermon on the Mount, he talks about going the second mile. And here's the illustration that I found. The only thing I don't like about Jesus carrying the luggage for this family whose car is broken down is he's not walking with the family. That's a problem. He seems to be a little bit angry too. But you know, the going of the second mile has to do with Roman law that people in an occupied country had to carry their baggage for them for a mile. And the Jews were very careful to have those miles marked out so that they could slam down that luggage as soon as they got to the mile marker. You know, that's not what Jesus has in mind. He says, go ahead, carry it another mile. Show them your good will toward them as a person. Turning the other cheek, loving of neighbors, that's all the proactive ethics of Jesus. That's all the doing, not the don'ting. Okay? Jesus tells a parable of a demon-possessed man who is cleansed. The demon goes out of his house. The house is swept, it's empty, but the person doesn't put anything in it. And the demon says, oh, nice big house. I'm going to go get seven other demons worse than I am, and we're going to go back in, and we're going to make the latter state worse than the first for this person. What this parable is all about is filling your life with good things, not just emptying them of bad things. The story of the compassionate Samaritan, you know, as the priest and the Levite went by, they didn't kick the guy, they didn't beat him up more, or steal what was left of his belongings that the thieves left behind. They just didn't do anything good for him. They didn't help him. And the compassionate Samaritan definitely did, going way out of his way. And the two coins that he gives the innkeeper, I'm told, will pay for a week of convalescence at the inn. The parable of the rich man and Lazarus. The rich man is feasting, and Lazarus is right outside his gate, maybe within sight of him. And the rich man does nothing to help him, and Lazarus dies and is carried by the angels to Abraham's side for the great messianic banquet, while the rich man finally dies and wakes up in hell. The parable of the unworthy servant, Jesus says in Luke 17, after you've done everything you're required to do, you should say, I'm an unworthy servant. I've only done my duty. I haven't done anything beyond that. I don't deserve a medal for doing what I'm supposed to do. The parable of the minas, where the master gives the same sum of money to each one of these men, and the men have varying success at making a profit. Some bring back a lot, and one guy only just goes out and buries it. There he is in the background digging it up again so he can give it to his master. I've given you what belongs to you because I knew how bad and evil you are, is really what he's saying. I knew you were such a hard guy and such an oppressor of people that you're demanding, and so I was afraid and I hid your money. It's all an insult to the owner. What he's really wanting is for someone to take that money and bring a profit. And you just take that into the parable of the virgins, and the idea of it is, what are you doing that is right? Not what are you doing that, what have you avoided that's wrong? All 10 of them are virgins. Look what Jesus is saying. Okay? It's not that the wiser virgins and the foolish lose their virginity. That's not the point of the parable. They're all virgins. Okay? As far as what you avoid that's wrong, they're all successful at that. But the question is, what are they doing that's right? Okay? You know, we could ask, why would Jesus choose virgins? Why not the 10 widows or the 10 mothers? They're all like weddings. You know, everybody loves a wedding, and I believe that Jesus is choosing the virgins for a very special reason. And, you know, here's basically what being a virgin was about in the first century. Probably today, too, the first person says, no means no. And 8 of the other ones hold up their signs, you know, no. And the person on the right, she has a t-shirt that says, no means no, and so does pepper spray. Okay? So they were all very successful at avoiding losing their virginity. That's not the point of the parable. Okay? The point is, the distinction is, not whether a sin is violated, but whether something good is being neglected. Okay, so that leads us to look at the context, and the very next parable after the parable of the virgins is the parable of the talents, where what he said about the minas is amplified when he talks about their talents, because talent was worth a lot of money, like a couple thousand dollars is what each one of these talents is worth. Okay, so The question is, what are you doing that's good? Not what you didn't avoid. You didn't steal the money, but did you bring any profit? And then it goes immediately into the parable of the sheep and goats, which again has the stress on what you did for the least of these my brothers, you did for me. Okay, so we also should give us a little bit of background, some unfamiliar wedding customs, and this is actually one of those figurines that's on a cake, but the guy is holding a basketball and the woman is trying to steal it away from him. I guess they're really fixated on that sport to put that on the top of their cake. But we're unfamiliar with some of these wedding customs, and there's three steps involved in wedding customs in the first century. The first step is the contract, okay? So there's this negotiation that goes on between the bridegroom and the father of the bride, and that results in a written document that is a legal contract between them. And it specifies how much the bridegroom is going to contribute toward the bride's dowry, and then when the next step is going to happen. That's what has to be in that contract. Second step is, we don't have contracts like that, except we do have rules for dating. So, Joe, pay attention to this part of the lesson, if nothing else, okay? The 11 rules for dating my daughter. You can go through those. I especially like the one that says, I don't mind going back to prison. You might want to just check out that slide later on. Okay, and then the next step is the consummation of the relationship. And we've got children here, we're not going to get into the details, but the idea is that their union as husband and wife usually takes place at the groom's house. So he goes and he picks up the bride at her house. Then they go through the street of the city. This is a public thing. Everybody approves and is showing their approval by the rejoicing. There is a consummation. And it's very foreign to our thinking, but people are waiting, listening, waiting to hear the bridegroom's voice to say that the consummation has happened, and then the party begins. That's the next step, okay? And this goes all the way back to Isaac and Rebekah, where it says in the book of Genesis that Isaac took Rebekah into his mother's tent, and she became his wife. Okay, so the contract and the consummation, and then there's a big celebration, and this is the best picture I could find of the kind of celebration that I have in mind when I read about wedding celebrations in the first century. Everybody joins hands and they get in this big long train and kind of circle the bride and the groom, and they have a big party, and that party can continue for as long as 7 days. We read in John chapter 2, the party where Jesus and his disciples are there, and they start running out of wine, and Jesus turns the water into wine. That's part of that stage 3, part of the celebration. Now, there's another thing, if you want to think of it geographically, we need to be talking about the triangular plan, okay? So what we've got here is a diagram of a typical first century city, and let me just say, in my thinking in the past, I haven't really thought of a city like this. If you really look at the way these people lived, they lived an urban kind of lifestyle. They lived in apartments, okay? And if you try to pick out the way the streets work in this city, everything between the streets are fourplexes or more, okay? So they're situated in houses that are connected to other houses, and everybody knows their neighbors, and they probably know, you know, 50 people surrounding them, if not more. But I call it the triangular plan because really there's 3 houses that are important in this whole process. First, there's the bride's house, and then there's the groom's house, but there's also the place where the groom has his party, okay? So the groom has a party. We have what are called bachelor parties, not the same at all, but there is a celebration of the groom with his friends and with the groom's parents, and that's at the groom's party. And there might also be the negotiation for the bride that takes place at that. And people make speeches, and people read poems, and people have a song to sing, and that thing can just go on and on and on. It could last for hours and hours. Meanwhile, everybody's getting ready at the bride's house for the groom to come and pick up the bride, and then they're going to have a parade over to the groom's house. Okay, and everybody's getting that ready because that's the place where the consummation takes place. They're getting the room ready. They're getting the party ready. All of that's going to happen at the groom's house. So there's a parade that goes from the groom's house, from the groom's party to the bride's house. And then there's another parade, and I've been told that the second parade is they pick the longest route possible so that the most people of the community can be involved in the celebration. Maybe I should have made it zigzag, going from the bride's house to the groom's house. But that second party is when the bridegroom arrives, then everybody joins in that second celebration parade. And that's confirmed by a saying that is actually in Arabic, but it reflects first century customs. The saying is, through the streets to the groom's house winds a long line of torches. Then they scatter like a herd of sheep, of goats. The reason why they scatter is when everybody gets to the groom's house, only specially invited guests, the closest friends of the bride and groom, go in that night, because what are we waiting for? We're waiting for the consummation. And that's something that is a intimate, personal thing that only the family. There's also a risk that the consummation isn't going to happen. Okay, could be very embarrassing. It could even be fatal if the woman is not a virgin. But anyway, so only the special guests and the immediate family is invited into the groom's house, and everybody else is turned away until the following day. Okay, come back tomorrow, the celebration will continue. And so they scatter like goats. Okay, so this kind of pattern is what is behind the parable of the virgins. So let's go ahead and read it, Matthew chapter 25, starting with verse 1. Then the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were foolish, 5 of them were wise. For when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them, but the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. As the bridegroom was delayed, that's the bridegroom's party, it's taking longer and longer, they all became drowsy and slept. And verse 6, but at midnight there was a cry, "Here's the bridegroom, come out to meet him." Then all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps, and the foolish said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." But the wise answered, saying, "Since there will not be enough for us and for you, go rather to the dealers and buy for yourselves." And while they were going to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the marriage feast, and the door was shut. Afterward, the other virgins came also, saying, "Lord, Lord, open to us." But he answered, "Truly I say to you, I do not know you." So let's work on the points of correspondence between what Jesus said in the parable and what it means. So the first one is the wedding. It seems to be what it means is the Messiah's union with his people. The Lord is united with his people, and they're going to be that way forever. They're going to be united and celebrating. The groom is the Messiah. You can turn to Matthew 9, verse 15, where when Jesus is asked, "Why don't your disciples fast?" He says, "How can the friends of the bridegroom fast when the bridegroom is with them? The time will come when the bridegroom leaves them, then they will fast. But as long as he's with them," and he's talking about himself. So the Messiah is what the groom represents. This is also evident in John the Baptizer's words in John 3, verse 29, where he says, "The friend of the bridegroom is listening for the bridegroom's voice, and when he hears it, he rejoices. He must become greater, I must become less." He's talking about himself in his relationship to the groom, the Messiah, Jesus. And the bride, I put that in brackets because the bride is never even mentioned in this. It's kind of surprising that the bride isn't mentioned, but she's assumed. And we know the bride is the church. And Matthew 22 really focuses on the wedding banquet that a king gives to his son, and that would include the bride. And Ephesians chapter 5 describes the church as the bride of Christ. And then the arrival of the groom would be the return of Christ, and that fits with the context of Matthew chapters 24 and 25. And also the wise virgins, those disciples who are prepared for the second coming. The foolish virgins would be those who are not prepared. The wedding banquet is the eternal fellowship of Christ with his people. And the shut door represents the time when the day of judgment is over, when there's no more opportunity for things to change. Everything is set from then on. So the question is, what is the meaning of the oil? And different people have given different possible meanings for what the oil signifies. When you run out of oil, you have to go buy oil. Some have said it's talking about good deeds. Others said it's talking about the presence of God or thoughts or our lives. If you look back in the Old Testament, there's a really good passage for figuring out the symbolism of oil. It's found in Zechariah chapter 4, verses 2 through 6. And the prophecy goes, he said to me, "What do you see?" And I said, "I see and behold a lampstand all of gold with a bowl on top of it and seven lamps on it and seven lips on each of the lamps that are on the top of it. And there are two olive trees by it, one on each side of the bowl and the other on the left." So that picture is trying to show what that's all about. The lampstand's in the middle, and there are kind of pipes that are going from the olive trees to the lamp. So the suggestion is that it's supplying that lamp eternally with oil. It's never going to run out of oil because the trees are growing more olives all the time. And so he says, "What does this mean? What are these, my Lord?" I asked, and the angel said, "Do you not know what they are?" In other words, you should be able to figure this out, Zechariah. You're a smart guy. He says, "No, I don't understand." So then he said to me, "This is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts." So in the context of Zechariah, there were two leaders of the nation that had returned from exile. The whole purpose of Zechariah's ministry is to get the people to rebuild the temple. They keep coming up with excuses. We don't have enough power, military power, to defend ourselves from our enemies so that we could do that and rebuild the temple. And once we get our security out of the way, then we can rebuild the temple. And the point of this parable is, you're not going to do it by might or by power. You're not going to make yourself secure that way, but only by my spirit. And I'm supplying my spirit to you continually. Okay? It's always going to be there for you. People have said, well, the Holy Spirit then must be what the oil is all about. But there are problems with this interpretation. First of all, since the spirit is a person, how do you run short of a person? You know, you can't have 20% spirit. It doesn't work that way. How does this fit with falling asleep? Because they both fall asleep. Did you notice that? The wise fall asleep as well as the foolish. And do you go and buy the Holy Spirit? That doesn't make any sense. And the biggest problem with it is that Jesus provides his own interpretation of what this parable is all about. And that's verse 13. He says, "Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour." In other words, Jesus doesn't give us what the oil means. He doesn't tell us the meaning of all the details in the parable. But he does give us this one general point. Pay attention. Don't let this hour take you by surprise. Okay? So the question is, will the lamp you receive still be burning at midnight? And, how can we be ready? Let me suggest three things. Number one, realize this, he is already on his way. Okay? He is coming. This is an inevitable thing that is going to happen in our future. The Lord is going to return. He's going to be He's going to come. And the second thing is, make your preparations in advance. There will be no opportunity at the last minute. Okay? And the third thing is, stick to your priorities. Don't give away your readiness to anyone else. Okay? Don't say, well, this person really needed my help, and I, you know, and that distracted me. I got my focus on them and not on the Lord's return. That's not going to work. And the fourth thing, I said there were three things. The fourth thing, the Lord will welcome all of us in who are ready for that eternal celebration. Okay? It's worth it, in other words. It's worth the preparation and the being ready. So, I want to focus on this verse from the Sermon on the Mount at the close of our lesson, Matthew chapter 5, verse 16. Let your light shine before others so they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. We do need to avoid sin. We do need to obey the don'ts of what the Lord has warned us about. But focus on the do's, and the don'ts will take care of themselves. If you want to become a Christian this morning, or if you want the prayers of this congregation for any need, or if you want to express thing that you are needing that we can help you with, we invite you to come as we stand and sing.